Scrolling for June 18th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hassenflohm.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here with the last of the Sherlock Holmes short stories, His Last Bow. There's no more short stories after this, right, Pam?
Well, you would have thought that, right? By the fact that this is His Last Bow, an epilogue of Sherlock Holmes, renamed from His Last Bow, The War Service of Sherlock Holmes. But no, we got like 12 more stories. Settle it.
I thought last story of the collection. The
I will give you that.
All right. So this is the last short story in this collection that is called The Last Bow, Some Reminiscences of Sherlock Holmes. We have a big time jump on this one, huh?
You thought when it takes place?
Well, first of all, when it takes place, and second of all, when it was published. This one was published in September of 1917, mm-hmm. The 30 years after the publishing of the first Holmes tale, A Study in Scarlet, in 1887. 30 years of Sherlock Holmes stories. And you're right, this is set in August of 1914.
And he's coming out of retirement to do this, Steve.
This is a 60-year-old Holmes coming out of retirement, mentioning his bees that he's been keeping.
Absolutely, in a very funny way.
Yes.
Of course. Yes. You know, and it's interesting. So I'm currently teaching a utopia and dystopia class, and my students and I have been really thinking through, like, what does 100 years mean, right? What will the world be like 100 years in the future? What was it like in 1920? And when you think of those dates, 1887 to 1917, think how much the world changed between the first Holmes and this 45th, 46th story, right?
Well, you think about the first aircraft, say from Kitty Hawk, was it 1904, 1907, sure. Something of that nature. We have trains connecting the world, but the car is not really here yet.
Sure it is.
Yes, it is. Yes, they are driving a Ford in this story, remember.
Oh, that's right. All right, so we're at the beginning of automobiles, and we certainly are not connected the way we are today. And, you know, what is it? 50 years from now, 60 years from now, you know, we're landing a person on the moon. So if you are a person growing up or a young person growing up during this era, the world changed tremendously during this period.
Absolutely.
Just and has in the last 30 years. I mean, exactly. It's amazing. The innovation happens so quickly. And yes, in this, you're right. 50 years from now is the moon landing, 1969, 52 years after this publication. Yep. It's stunning.
Yeah. And it's something that I think Doyle is very much thinking about. You know, we've talked about how he focuses on epistemological changes, how people think about knowledge and technological changes, all kinds of changes around the natural, the supernatural. He's fascinated by how the world is changing. And Sherlock Holmes, and again, I think this is part of why Sherlock is still alive and with us today in 2020 in so many different variations, is because Holmes lived through this time and really had different perspectives on the different moments of his life from Study in Scarlet through to His Last Bow. And which brings us to the question of genre. Is this detective fiction?
No, this is not a detective story. This is absolutely a spy story taking place at the height of World War I, which started in 1914. This being published in 1917, it was a year or so until World War I was declared over. And this is definitely a spy story.
Is he 001?
001. Well, the spy genre started quite a bit before this, in 1821, and in 1831, James Fenimore Cooper published the first two spy fiction books. The first one called The Spy, and the second one called The Bravo. So this is well into that genre, but it's still, you know.
You're saying it's not a James Bond?
Well, James Bond doesn't come around until 1953, so this is certainly a predecessor to Ian Fleming.
So this story is different in terms of its genre, absolutely, and also its narrative style. Now, how much were you guys noticing that the story is written in the third person, where Watson and Holmes are the two friends, instead of it being Watson when the first person telling you about his friend Holmes.
Well, I noticed that because I was kept waiting for, usually at the beginning, Watson kind of leads us into the story.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't there to do that.
Right. Now, did it impact how you read the story that you didn't have Watson as your sort of liaison?
It really affected the way that I envisioned the scene. This was much more like an episode of a TV show. This was a cold open that went through half of the story because we were thrown into this situation. We're absolutely just thrown into the middle of this conversation between these two characters that we don't know who they are. We're trying to figure out who they are and what they're saying, what they're doing, why this is happening in a Sherlock Holmes story. If this was an episode of a TV show, this would not be a great episode of Sherlock Holmes.
So why do you think Doyle did it? Why did he set it up in the third person instead of having Watson narrate?
My thought was reading this was, is this a Captain America story? Or as we would call it, maybe Captain Britain, sort of a propaganda piece that maybe the government or some propaganda machine in Britain came to him and asked Doyle to write a story during this wartime experience. Because we are, in 1917, we're 3 years into the war at that point. Take a national treasure, you know, make him bust the spies, and let's go win a war.
Just like they did with Bugs Bunny, making those characters, those well-known American characters, fight in the war, because that was on the minds of everybody around the world.
Is that because he took a wrong turn in Albuquerque?
Yes, that's why. That's what happened. That's why World War One happened.
Okay, just saying that.
Everything's about
cartoons. I should note that for future.
There we go. It's either cartoons or puppets for me. That's all there is to it. The third person, it puts us into the scene in a way that is different from when we are experiencing it through the lens of Watson's vision. And it puts us into kind of like a spy role where we are seeing it for ourselves. That's a very interesting trick here.
And thank goodness we have all the experience of reading all the Sherlock Holmes stories beforehand, because this one certainly is, so when I say so different, it's just a different way of presenting a story.
Yeah, I think I would have been disappointed if this was our first one.
Right. Yes, it does call upon our previous knowledge of Holmes and Watson, for sure. So let's go to the opening. And again, let's just feel how really different this is. It was 9 o'clock at night upon the 2nd of August, the most terrible August in the history of the world. One might have thought already that God's curse hung heavy over a degenerate world, for there was an awesome hush and a feeling of vague expectancy in the sultry and stagnant air. The sun had long set, but one blood-red gash like an open wound lay low in the distant west. Above, the stars were shining brightly, and below, the lights of the shipping glimmered in the bay. The two famous Germans stood, and blah, 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 we get the description. Now, what do you guys notice about that?
I think the contemporaries of Noah would totally disagree with it was the worst August.
Yeah, but you guys, like World War One was pretty terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, people really worried that it was the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. People are always worried about that, Pam. People always worry it's the end of the world. Every year, I have a student come up to me and go, did you hear about the calendar? We found the calendar. This is the end of the world. Humans have thought that forever. But yes, this was a traumatic time, and we have a traumatic scene opening here.
Well, and if you think of World War One or the Great War, the war to end all wars, yeah, the bubonic plague. At any point, you have something that's so jarring to your everyday life. You're struggling already, and now you've got this incredible, I don't know,
disruption.
COVID-19 type of situation. We're certainly not in anything that is as negative as maybe what they felt on during the Great War. But you could just see.
I disagree with
every day person, it's just really, really heavy for them.
I think the disruption of this pandemic that we're in has certainly the same ramifications as a war. It has all of the possibilities of death all around us at any moment. And it's even more frightening to me sometimes because it's invisible.
But you're suffering with Netflix and with Amazon Prime and Hulu and all those other things. During that time, you know, they were starving, like starving.
True.
The food banks certainly were different at that time. People lived a little bit differently. This is the Industrial Revolution, so many people had to pick up from their if they had a rural life where they were starving, they ended up moving to the city. I mean, I don't know, maybe if you were a first-generation person in Wuhan, in China, maybe it feels that way because, I mean, it's not like you can even grow your food. The place that you left is no longer really around at that point. I recognize how heavy this is. Anyway, I'll stop.
Well, and if I can just go back to the quote for a moment, I think the idea that one might have thought already that God's curse hung heavy over a degenerate world, there's an awesome hush and a feeling of vague expectancy. This really reminds me of the W.H. Auden poem, The Second Coming, which is coming out like a couple years later. Just this notion that people are really, really questioning what is the future. And of course, Steve, you're right. We always do that. But I think it's a bit of an idea of God's curse, you know, trying to process a huge war like that in a world where religion is still very much a way that people process things. And it's a huge deal.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that World War I was not a huge deal, but
I know.
we always have a huge deal. There's always something that is disrupting and making it hard to whatever normal is to be maintained. So let's get back to the story. We have these Germans who are having this conversation, and Baron von Bork is my favorite new name.
That certainly doesn't sound like a made-up name.
Oh, Doyle.
He is like a wandering eagle, you guys. He has perched himself on a great chalk cliff overlooking the beach. And I think the descriptions of this German are very, very interesting. A remarkable man, this von Bork, could hardly be matched among all the devoted agents of the Kaiser. It was his talents which had first recommended him for the English mission, the most important mission of all. But since he had taken it over, those talents had become more and more manifest to the half dozen people in the world who were really in touch with the truth. Ooh, I like that. Were these guys really in touch with the truth, my friends? Sherlock Holmes wants you to see it, right?
Yeah. mean, right. This is looking at perspectives.
Totally playing with us. This third person narrator should be reliable, right? We always know when we're reading through Watson's eyes, we know we have a somewhat unreliable narrator with the whole like, oh, Sherlock Holmes. You're just a straight up third person narrator, also unreliable.
He's meeting with Baron von Herling, whose huge 100-horsepower Benz car was blocking the country lane. Interesting. That's an interesting symbol there.
Yes.
Von Herling warns him of the traps in the spy business.
There are traps in the spy business.
Von Bork is not worried because he is a natural sportsman. He uses his athleticism to be in places where he can learn things. And he's super proud of his accomplishments, right? So he shows Baron von Herling his rows of stuffed pigeonholes. And all in 4 years, Baron, not such a bad show for the hard-drinking, hard-riding country squire. But the gem of my collection is coming, and there is the setting all ready for it. He pointed to a space over which naval signals was printed. So he is waiting for one of his agents to bring him the final piece of the puzzle. So again, Britain is in danger. We are now in enemy territory looking at high-level enemy intelligence operators.
So the first lesson here is when you start receiving your intelligence, just hold on to it and bring it in one time because, you know, sending it, you know, piece by piecemeal, it doesn't really help. We should have it all put together. The German way is like, make sure it's all organized before, you know, sending it over.
Organization. It's important to the spy business. This is all happening on English soil. This is all about spies among us. And that's where I think the propaganda piece really kicks in here. These are Germans talking about the English. And the quote that I really liked in a way, but at the same time, it really creeped me out. They are not very hard to deceive, he remarked. A more docile, simple folk could not be imagined. This is an English writer writing to English people about spies among us.
Are they saying that Doyle is saying that, hey, we don't be naive, maybe.
Correct. Be more aware of your surroundings. Be more careful with your words. This is a thing that goes around World War One and World War II.
Loose lips sink ships.
Precisely. So that's where we're at in history. The other quote really gets me too. Well, that makes it more effective. You yacht against them. You hunt with them. You play polo. You match them in every game. Your four in hand takes the prize at Olympia. I have even heard that you go the length of boxing with the young officers. What is the result? Nobody takes you seriously. You're a good old sport. Quite a decent fellow for a German. A hard-drinking nightclub knockabout town, devil-may-care young fellow. And all the time, this quiet country house of yours is the center of half of the mischief in England. And the sporting squire, the most astute Secret Service man in Europe. Genius, my dear von Bork. Genius. This is propaganda. This is look out. Look out for the Germans. If you know a German guy, he might be the center of a spy ring.
He may be a good guy, but he may not be a good guy.
I can be a good guy without being a good guy. Cartoons. It's all back to cartoons for me. We also have a bit of a lump on the Irish here, because we have an Irish character, an Irish-American character, no less, who comes in.
Well, we already know what Americans are thought of, Steve, according to this. But you know, an Irish-American. And it's really important to kind of remember that the Irish potentially, Pam, could have bear some ill will towards the English. There was, in 1845, the potato boy, which led to a large group of immigrants coming to the United States. The Irish population, I mean, imagine you are a mom or a dad watching your kids dying, and you just basically escape to the United States to try to set up a better life for yourself. And there's this massive, massive group of Irish that are immigrating to the United States. And at one point, between 1820 and 1860, the Irish constituted one-third of all immigrants coming to the United States. They come to the United States, they build families. That potential ill will may not go away. And obviously, Doyle is using that when he takes on his disguised character with his soul patch.
Yes. And it's interesting because we are going to see Irish Americans again when we get to Doyle's final novel of Sherlock Holmes, The Valley of Fear. It's about a secret society in the U.S. that's an Irish secret society.
Mm-hmm. And secret societies also, they go back and forth between have negative connotations and be beneficial. So back and forth on that.
Yeah, where's the shadow government when we need it?
I also wanted to note, maybe there was a statement of the time that we're living in. It's an inconceivable thing. But even our special war tax of $50 million, which one would think made our purpose as clear as if we had advertised it on the front of the Times. This is a little bit of where England and Germany kind of are competing with each other. They're rivals in many, many ways. They're friendly rivals many times, but now they're at war.
And nothing is prepared, the German says. England is not prepared. especially when we have stirred her up such as a devil's brew of the Irish Civil War, window-breaking furies, and God knows what to keep her thoughts at home. That idea of distraction, we've heard this on the news and in all sorts of commentaries the last few weeks. Is there a distraction that the Germans are adding to the mix in order to be successful in this war? This is pretty deep writing from Doyle. And no, this is not Sherlock Holmes yet. We get the image of John Bull, who many people might not be familiar with. John Bull is the personification of England, kind of like our Uncle Sam, that cartoonish character who is the character that we get behind, maybe. Usually he's depicted as a stout, middle-aged, country-dwelling, jolly, and matter-of-fact man. Like maybe a Robbie Coltrane sort of character. Jolly, happy, hi, I'm England. We're going to go to war now. Everybody come with me.
Wow, you sound like part of the propaganda machine, my friend.
That's my middle name.
And then finally, we get to Altamont.
Good.
Now, this is an Irish-American double agent who's bringing information to the Germans. I love how we use every conceivable American stereotype, and we know that Doyle loves to do this.
You so, and your Coca-Cola and pizza.
He says, the Irish-American had entered the study and stretched his long limbs from the armchair. He was a tall, gaunt man of 60, with clear-cut features and a small goatee beard, which gave him a general resemblance to the caricatures of Uncle Sam. You can give me the glad hand tonight, mister, he cried. I'm bringing home the bacon at last.
Like,
and you read that so perfectly for them.
Sorry.
Ah, that was so awesome.
Forgive me.
Sounded so Canadian.
Oh, no. I'm bringing home the bacon at last. Like, oh my goodness, he's a loud man with his white yes. tennis shoes.
Yes.
Wearing his shorts and his shirt that says a sports team on it.
He really pushes Van Bork on his security, right? So when he looks at the safe, he's like, gosh, in a wide open contraction like that? And Von Burke's like, no, it's great. Altamont asks about the lock, and he seems to have a lot of trouble understanding the explanation. He's like, search me. It's beyond me. And then, as the guy's explaining the lock, he says, the American's face showed his surprise and admiration. And that's when Von Burke explains he's using a super good password, August 1914. And Altamont says, my, but that was smart.
I just love this. So another note that we should have, if you're ever a spy, use a date and make sure you tell other people what the combination is. Good Lord.
To explain how smart you are.
Oh, good Lord.
Doyle is telling us here that spies are all around you, reader. He says, Steiner is the fifth man you've lost. I signed on with you, and I know the name of the sixth. If I don't get a move on. Sorry, I should have done an American. If I don't get a move on. How do you explain it? And ain't you ashamed to see your men go down like this?
Oh my God.
The American.
I think that he doesn't have a lot of respect for the American accent.
We are certainly the butt of this joke in Doyle's writing. That is for certain.
Well, maybe we'll have a writer take it back to him, you know?
The American wants to see the dough, the boodle, the reward for giving up his package.
And now, here's where we get the Sherlockian touches. Now, you guys, I'm sure the three of us reading our 44th Sherlock Holmes story in a row, we're quite well aware that Altamont was Sherlock. But, you know, if you weren't quite sure, here's where you get it. Von Bork untied a winding of string and two wrappers of paper. Then he sat gazing for a moment in silent amazement at a small blue book which lay before him. Across the cover was printed in golden letters, Practical Handbook of Bee Culture.
I think that Doyle may be writing something to the readers who've read Sherlock Holmes.
And then immediately, Only for one instant did the master spy glare at this strangely irrelevant description. The next, he was gripped at the back of his neck by a grasp of iron, and a chloroformed sponge was held in front of his writhing face. "Another glass, Watson," said Mr. Sherlock Holmes as he extended the bottle of Imperial Tokay. Oh, I love it. This is the moment. And you don't know that Watson is there, right? Like, that's what I love about it, is that I knew Altamont was Sherlock, but I didn't know that Watson was there. Did you guys?
No.
I sort of did. When they said that the chauffeur was an overweight man and he was standing there, I was like, oh, there they are. I found them.
So Sherlock and John are reunited. It turns out Sherlock has been spying for years and has planted tons of false info with the Germans.
Of course he has. Or at least he's claiming to have been the master spy in the world.
But I love the reunion. But you, Watson, he stopped his work and took his old friend by the shoulders. I've hardly seen you in the light yet. How have the years used you? You look the same blithe boy as ever. I feel 20 years younger, Holmes. I have seldom felt so happy as when I got your wire asking me to meet you at Harwich with the car. But you, Holmes, you have changed very little, save for that horrible goatee. These are the sacrifices one makes for one's country, Watson, said Holmes, pulling at his little tuft. Tomorrow it will be but a dreadful memory.
I don't like your facial hair. You should really shave that.
Steve.
I like my facial hair, and everybody around me likes my facial hair. When I shave, people go, oh, you should grow that back.
Oh, my God.
But this is a reunion, and they both look really great. They've both, you know, the years have been kind to both of them. They're both in good shape. They're super recognizable.
And they're energized by this activity.
Exactly. Honey is really good for you. I mean, as a beekeeper, I'm sure you eat plenty of it.
Well, and Holmes goes on to describe this when he holds up his book. Here is the fruit of my leisured ease, the magnum opus of my later years. He picked up the volume from the table and read out the whole title, Practical Handbook of Bee Culture, with some observations upon the segregation of the queen. Alone I did it. Behold the fruit of pensive nights and laborious days, when I watched the little working gangs, as once I watched the criminal world of London. He seems happy, right?
Well, totally. J.K. Rowling later on will use this same sort of trope with her professors at Hogwarts as they write their magnum opuses too.
Well, and it's interesting because throughout the stories, we've seen Holmes write several monographs, right? Mm-hmm. On all kinds of things, from cigarette ash to the distinction of ears to the motets of lasses. What do we have yesterday? We had, Celtic origins of language. A philology book. I mean, he's been writing about all kinds of things, but you get the feeling that bees and that notion that bee culture in some ways can act as a microcosm of human culture, looking at all those little working gangs, right? As once he watched the criminal world. And I think the subtitle of the book is important too. He has some observations upon the segregation of the queen. A lot of ways to read that. Especially in terms of the really complex representations we've had of gender throughout the entire canon, and the fact that Holmes has met Queen Victoria, and we have, you know, so there's a lot to unpack, I think. And I would just note, I know I've mentioned it before, that Laurie R. King's excellent series, the Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes novels, picks up Holmes in his beekeeping phase and really does amazing work in thinking through the whole canon to this point.
Mm-hmm. Von Bork says that he'll get even with Altamont when he finally wakes up from the chloroform. The old sweet song, said Holmes. How often I've heard it in days gone by. It was a favorite ditty of the late lamented Professor Moriarty. Colonel Sebastian Moran has also been known to warble it. And yet I live to keep bees upon the South Downs. Nobody can touch me, sir. Not even you, Von Bork.
And it does feel like Doyle thought this would be the last story, right? He calls back all of his greatest hits.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, if the guy ever does escape, you know, why not just give him your address, where you're staying? Down to South Downs, hanging out with the bees. Oh, if I get down there, just ask for the beekeepers. Okay.
Von Bork wants to know who the traitor is. Holmes lets his work speak for itself. It was I who brought about the separation between Irene Adler and the late King of Bohemia, and your cousin Heinrich was the imperial envoy. Once again, making a list. Hey, everybody, if you haven't read any Sherlock Holmes stories, you should really look up Irene Adler right now.
Well, and I think Doyle is certainly giving a little wink to the readers. Hey, you know, if you've read all these, or if you haven't read all these, go back and see what we where these came from.
And Von Bork groans and sinks back onto the sofa. And most of that information came through you, he cried. What is it worth? What have I done? It is my ruin forever. It is certainly a little untrustworthy, said Holmes.
with a smile.
Right?
It seems like you have bad information. I don't...
But a complete list of bad information. A single volume.
Very well organized.
The nice pigeonholes and everything. And then Sherlock ends this conversation with Von Bork in a really satisfying way, I think. But you have one quality, which is very rare in a German, Mr. Von Bork. You are a sportsman, and you will bear me no ill will when you realize that you, who have outwitted so many other people, have at last been outwitted yourself. After all, you have done your best for your country, and I have done my best for mine. And what could be more natural? Besides, he added, not unkindly, as he laid his hand upon the shoulder of the prostrate man, it is better than to fall before some more ignoble foe.
Doyle.
Well, at least we did it fair and square.
Right. And as gentlemen, we won't do anything after this because you understand that I did a great job here. How English is this? My God.
Good job, Def.
And this idea, which has come up again and again throughout the canon, that it's better to get beat by someone who's great than someone who gets lucky, right? And so, Holmes is constantly delighted when he finds a criminal who is worthy of his own skills as a detective. And so he's kind of bringing that to bear here. He's like, you're a sportsman. There's got to be something a little satisfying about this. You got beat by someone better than you.
Isn't that what you wanted? Isn't that what you wanted, Von Bork? Didn't you want a really good foe? Because that's what I like to have.
Sherlock.
We have this ending, Pam. Boy, is this a long, contrived ending that really sounds like Doyle was wrapping up this story, doesn't it?
Yes. So the two friends chatted in intimate converse for a few minutes, recalling once again the days of the past, while their prisoner vainly wriggled to undo the bonds that held him. As they turned to the car, Holmes pointed back to the moonlit sea and shook a thoughtful head. There's an east wind coming, Watson. I think not, Holmes. It is very warm. Good old Watson. You are the one fixed point in a changing age. There's an east wind coming all the same. Such a wind as never blew on England yet. It will be cold and bitter, Watson, and a good many of us may wither before its blast. But it's God's own wind nonetheless, and a cleaner, better, stronger land will lie in the sunshine when the storm has cleared. Start her up, Watson, for it's time that we were on our way. I have a check for £500, but should be cashed early, for the drawer is quite capable of stopping it if he can. Wow, there's a lot going on here. So we have this moment of reminiscence.
No champagne, no bottle of wine.
This is not joyous. This is certainly... fading into the sunset here. Absolutely.
Well, and we have the two men catching up. And we, of course, as readers, are catching up in this sort of nostalgic way. Because this isn't, you know, there's something about this final story written in the third person. It doesn't feel like any other story we've had from the whole canon. So we have, the nostalgia is built into the story. It's not like all the others. It's a reflection. And so we have this nostalgia for our younger friends in the 19th century before we were in the middle of a world war, of a great war. And Holmes can read always the situation, right? It's going to get worse before it gets better. And Watson's like, no, I think it's going to get better.
It's fine. Everything's fine.
And we know Watson, and we love Watson. We love that optimism. Mm-hmm. But we know he's wrong. And when Holmes says that, you are the one fixed point in a changing age. I mean, not to get all nostalgic for yesterday's story, but we see Holmes's heart there. He loves that. But that's not who he is either, right?
But isn't he also saying, you are still as dumb as you always were? You are still as wrong as you always were? Isn't that the fixed point?
I think he's saying you are still as reliable as you always were. And you guys, I mean, I'm teaching utopian literature right now, so I'm in the midst of that. But we need hope, right? And so if you're like a cynical Sherlock Holmes, you've got to have a Watson, or you can't even function. You have to have an optimist. Don't you think, in a way, that's what works between these two characters?
Well, it certainly works between the characters. I've done a little bit of study in Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln suffered from depression. And there is an argument that people who do go through sort of the melancholy, as it was described at the time, have this ability to ride out and sort of internally have a little bit of optimism. It allows them to ride out the bad times. We're in the middle of World War One here, World War One. It's dark. There's not a lot of food. There's rations going on. Maybe not a lot of fuel around to get things here and there. People are coming back. They're injured. There's all sorts of negative stuff going around them. So I can't help but think we're still in the middle of World War One. That is painting a little bit of how Doyle or Sherlock could be thinking about this. They don't know if this war is going to go on for another year, which it is, or if it goes on for another 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever it is. They certainly don't know about World War II.
Right. And I think that what's really important here, just building on off what you just said, is that, you know, Watson is that fixed point. And Holmes says, listen, this wind is going to be horrible, right? Bitter times are in front of us, but it's God's own wind nonetheless. A cleaner, better, stronger land will lie in the sunshine after the storm has cleared, after the war is over. And so he's able, I think, to pick up on and incorporate Watson's fundamental optimism into his own worldview. Even though he has the clearer eye, he also has the clearer eye for hope as well as distress.
This is not a Sherlock Holmes story. This is a spy story with all sorts of baggage from the time tied into it. There was certainly baggage from the time in the other tales, but this is just almost all baggage.
Is this the end of an era? I mean, think about where... What are we thinking of the beginning of the Sherlock Holmes tales, where we're in, certainly in a very prosperous time, relatively speaking. The world is changing. There's all sorts of excitement things going on.
And what a do we meta-narrative have? Of progress, right?
Yeah.
So the 1880s have a meta-narrative of progress. So it's the exact opposite time of the 19-teens.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the writing of the time certainly reflects that, just like the writing of this time, this COVID, this staying at home. We're going to get some interesting stories of loneliness and all sorts of things that are going to happen as a result of this time, just like we got the Hunger Games out of the Great Recession of 2008.
Pam, do you know if as we read the next volume of short stories, do they take place after this time, or are they going back to the 1880s, 1890s?
They're going back.
Okay. So, you know, that's an interesting moment that they would take Holmes and Watson back, as opposed to if they continue to write from this period going forward, there would be a sort of maybe a different tone of the stories.
guess we'll find out. But first, before we get on to our next story, we need to wrap up his last bow. We need to select our favorites of this collection of stories. We'll do that tomorrow. We would love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your favorites. And we will put that all together tomorrow and get on to our next Sherlock Holmes story, believe it or not. There's still more.
And I think our next thing we'll read is The Sign of Four.
Woo-hoo! So
going back to an earlier novel, and I have to say, I've really enjoyed reading the novel slightly out of order with the stories. I think it is fun to see how Doyle's style has changed and how the relationship between the two main characters has changed too.
So you tell us, have you enjoyed it as much as we have? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text, send us an email, follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all that feedback from around the world. And make sure you go to our dedicated website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, to find all of these conversations. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
Where's my sandwich?